Welcome to Disrupt Disruption, a series of intimate interviews with global thought leaders and practitioners operating at the intersection of business, leadership, and technology. We're discussing all things innovation and disruption and how to not only survive but thrive in these times of exponentially accelerating change. Trusted by CEOs, founders, and leaders globally for the latest take on business models, methods, culture, and leadership, we cut to the chase, debunk the hype, and get real. You're in great company. I'm your host, Pascal Finette, co-founder of Be Radical. Everybody, this is Pascal. I am super, super, super excited to be here with another episode of Disrupt Disruption today with Gustav Stromfeld. Gustav used to be the lead for the blockchain portfolio and the innovation accelerator, as well as a venture designer over at the World Food Program. He is obsessed about design, technology, and the observation of society and bringing those three things together. He has done work in innovation strategy, business design, venture design, and he calls himself, and probably we get there, a dissatisfied idealist. So I love that framing. Gustav, it's awesome to have you here.
It's really nice to be here as well. It's really cool to be able to have this conversation with you.
Gustav, first question. I always love to ask that question and get us started. How do you even think and or define innovation?
They're two different things for me. Innovation and disruption are totally different things. So innovation is the translation of ideas into things, products, interventions, items, things that can be and can exist that we can touch, that we can sense. Disruption is the kind of external effects that those might have and normally unintended consequences that take place when innovation is implanted into a system that wasn't effectively ready for it.
Interesting. Let me pick this up. So do you think you can be thoughtful, planful, deliberate about disruption, or is it indeed an unintended consequence of well-executed?
That's interesting. So that's a very, very interesting way of thought, right? That can you be planned about how you break things is what it seems to, which I think you can, right? You can actively disrupt environments to get to a specific end goal. You can implant individuals into teams that create conflict to then get the team past specific roles. You can do the same with societies, with communities, and so on. I think maybe the way that I framed disruption in that case was more related specifically to kind of how I remember at IBM when we were talking about disruption to clients, we were talking about the Netflix taking on Blockbuster and Uber taking on taxi drivers and Amazon taking on literally every shop on the face of the planet. So when you think about that, what we're effectively doing is we're implanting a new system from an old one and in an environment where it's arguable, the question of whether the world has become a better place is one that can be quite fiercely argued. It's definitely become more convenient, but the question is, has it become better? And I think those are two different questions one needs to ask. Now, I think when we think about it in terms of organizational strategy, you can be purposefully disruptive. You can say, well, you know, if I look at IBM as another example, IBM very much innovated for a long time through acquisition. And so what it would effectively do is it would hoover up another wonderful business and then remove another part of it, of the organization, in so doing, creating significant amounts of disruption. The same has been done with many other organizations that go through any form of hockey curve. Whenever we're creating anything new, there will be a period of disruptive lack of productivity, shall we call it. So, and that's not technically a bad thing. I think maybe there's probably multiple ways of defining this question of disruption right now. The question is, which one are we focusing on more than anything?
Yeah, you've been part of innovation and truly disruptive innovation at organizations like the World Food Program. I'm curious, what have you found in terms of your approach? What works? What are the steps you've been taking or the tools and instruments you've been using to make this work for you?
The most important thing is I've not aimed to disrupt. Ultimately, all good ideas started off with a good intention, right? And we created the car. Henry Ford creates the car. The car takes over the world, right? Disrupts natural ecosystems all over the world. The airplane disrupts the natural world just as much. But there's fantastically good intentions behind it. When, for example, I was coming up with the idea, working with a number of partners to transact cryptocurrencies to support Kenyan refugees in Kenya, which is now finally working after I left the World Food Program. The aim there was, well, look, we have a massive challenge, which is we cannot transact fiat currency from the United States, from white microwork providers in the United States to work providers of time and energy in Kenya. because they are unbanked. It costs too much for them to get access to PayPal. They're perennially tied to NGOs, and that's not the point of having a micro work program. They need to be independent earners that have the ability to earn digitally. And so we were like, well, is there any other way for us to do that? And yes, there was. Ultimately, we use a stable coin to transact from the United States to Kenya. And then we have an offboarding platform, which is normally integrated into something like M-Pesa on the other side. M-Pesa is a mobile money provider in Kenya, which then allows the Kenyan refugees to earn via straight onto their mobile phones. And so very, very quickly, you've solved that problem. Now, could it become disruptive? Could we fundamentally disrupt the flows of currency between the two countries? Are we going to know that yet? No. But at this particular moment, it was done with a good intention. I think that's something that's quite interesting, which is where it comes to that unintended consequence. Did we expect Amazon to take over the world? Did we expect AWS to become one of the very few cloud service providers? We didn't when it all started out. We started out with an online bookseller and we were like, well, this is fantastic. I don't need to go to the bookstore anymore. I don't need to go and order my book and get it in 3 weeks' time. That unintendedness of that disruption is something that I think we don't always necessarily remember. It comes back to that fractal thought we had, right? Which is that fractals continue to replicate themselves. And you only really get the picture of the fractal after the certain numbers of those replications. Every idea builds on a previous set of ideas. And I don't believe there's such a thing as like real novelty. I think it's just continuous evolution of interesting things. And then some things grow faster than others.
It sounds to me that when you start one of those parts of the fractal tree, you start with presumably a consumer need. It doesn't sound like you started out with like, I'm going to disrupt the payment industry. So how do you practically go about starting?
How do I go about start? So finding that consumer need or the need generally?
Yeah, well, I think also just where do you even begin?
Honestly, it starts with curiosity. It starts with just asking good questions. If we can ask good questions, if you're curious about what other people are doing, the likelihood is they're going to come up with a problem that can be solved with something that you either know about or that you are doing. And so starting off by asking questions to people who are experiencing problems. I was talking with, this idea came about simply through the fact that I was talking with one of my colleagues who was running this program and she was struggling with this issue. And I was like, well, fantastic. And like, I have this thing that we can try out. Let's see if this works. Now, I think that if you take that one step higher and you think, okay, so let's say I'm now the head of the innovation accelerator, and this isn't to comment on the management of the accelerator, but just to present some ideas. How could I support the higher levels of probability of such a thing happening? So the number one is just make sure that my staff are connecting to each other across disciplinary functions and across project functions. Make sure that they are not only talking about what they are doing, what they're interested in, but also exploring the problems and getting opportunities, most importantly, to connect at a personal level. So those continued relationships continue and then allow for the, what's the best way of putting it? Allow for the, yeah, maybe the, like the, I'm using a word that probably isn't the right one, but like the movement of free radicals within your organization so that that serendipity can take place. I was remember looking at office design when I was at IBM, and I was thinking and talking about the future of work and the productivity versus creativity. Creativity for me and the opportunity to turn what might look like a crazy idea into something that can be disruptive or something that can be innovative comes from simply being around people that are willing to entertain the ideas in the first place. And that, I think, is something that you can actually design into the way that you build your office. You can design it into the way that you build your spaces, into the way that you build your calendars. Do you schedule how you schedule your team meeting and the time around your team meeting? How you structure facilitated exercises? These can all lead you to allowing for that permeation of thought between teams.
Knowing that you left the World Food Program, you're on your way to an incredible learning experience on your end. Now, imagining going back into whatever context it is, a company, an organization, whatever, and you were to do this again. So you're tasked with, okay, so here, go and innovate, disrupt. What is it you would do?
Something Robbie said, actually, Robbie Stamp from the EV community. He said, we consulted or we mentioned that we should sometimes spend more time exploring. So I think the first thing I would do, rather than jumping to creating ideas, spend a lot more time exploring. And I am a person that is a fierce networker. I will actively let my tentacles grow through an organization so that I can find individuals who are presenting new ways of thinking to me, who can help me think about the different challenges that the organization is, would continue to do. So just as an individual who needs to be a venture designer, who needs to find opportunities to create things, especially if you're more of an intrapreneur, a large part of that is politics. And so really being able to identify the tribe that are willing to help you take your ideas forward is vital. I think the second thing is an analogous thought and analogous spaces. So right now I'm kind of looking into the community design of the EV community right now, like working with Maria and Azeem to try and figure out how we build out this community. And I'm noticing the relationship that all community, like the relationship that we have to other forms of community, like religious communities, for example, and other kind of story-bound communities, to understand, well, what are the things, what are the common threads that you experience between various communities that you can then implant? Because again, I don't believe there is such a thing as really deep levels of novelty. There are just simply new ways of doing things that look kind of new, but technically aren't actually that new. I mean, we've had Amazon just took ordering from your restaurant over the phone effectively and just put it online. It's not a huge jump. Netflix was being done by post for a long time. So the jump isn't huge in reality. And I think sometimes we might think that it is. So I think that's number two. So number one, really network. And when I say network, I really mean find the tribe, get to know them personally, like make them individuals and be an individual for them that is trusted, that is supportive, and that is there not only in professional environments, but predominantly in personal spaces as well, so that you can have that far closer relationship with people. The second one is don't overcomplicate innovation. So get into understanding the various threads that look similar, and then understand that you can do this slightly differently by using a new tool, technology, and practice, methodology, so on. The third thing is, if it makes the process more complicated, it will fail. So in terms of, like, the third thing is, if I look at the innovations that have worked, they have worked because there's the right people around it. So there's the tribe that have come together. Two, it's not hugely different from what currently existed. And it's still disruptive in terms of the fact that it can still change the paradigm and open up new spaces of opportunity, right? But it's not a huge jump into the future. You know, we're not trying to build nuclear plasma reactors in the World Food Program, right? So the third thing is it makes the process less complex. And if I can get those three things in line, the likelihood is I'm probably going to get something working.
I see a lot of organizations struggle with this notion between how do you manage the balance between many different terms, but core and edge, the old and the new. The old makes the money, the new is the future. Very often we see lack of support from the old for the new, or the new being ostracized, or on the flip side of that, all of the attention of the company is towards the new because it's the next shiny thing, mm-hmm. and to the detriment of cash cow, mm-hmm. the existing cash cow. How do you manage that from your perspective?
I think there are lots of different worlds of thought about this, right? But I subscribe in large part to Safi Bakal's analysis in Lunch, which is you need a separation between the two. And in many cases, you kind of need to let the new eat the old, kind of. He makes a distinction between franchise business and, I can't remember what he calls the other one, but I guess it's called loon shots. The franchise just learns to replicate itself. And I noticed this a lot in the World Food Program and almost every other organization I've worked in, is that they're fantastic at doing the same work continually. It was Sean Accor in a great TED talk where he talks about the secret of happiness and how to, he says the happy secret to better work is the name of his TED talk. Fantastic TED talk. It's just so easy to watch. And he goes, one of the reasons for dissatisfaction at work is we set you a sales target. You hit that sales target. We set you a new sales target, right? You have this continuous, like you're on this treadmill and the treadmill will never stop. So franchises are very good at replicating businesses, whereas or startups, new ventures are not about replication. They're about exploration to start off with. And then as they get towards replication, that's when they become scary for the larger business. For what I've seen at the World Food Program is that's the point when ideas start to fray. It's very easy to get lots and lots and lots of ideas at the beginning of the pipe. It's extremely difficult to convert them, is what I've noticed. To convert them into the business and turn them into something that is business ready, business applicable, and can scale and can grow, that is within the existing organization, that's extremely challenging. Now, if your initial business is a change to an internal core process, what you need is, and I saw this being done at VW for a while when I was at IBM, the guys built a really, really good process where what they did is they brought in all the gatekeepers. And the gatekeepers were people, like the organisms, the immune system of the organism. I love this idea of immune systems. The immune system of the organism is predominantly legal, procurement, your business functions, finance, right? And then possibly a couple of others within that space who are in line with the business function that your idea is challenging. So you need to make sure those individuals are already on board at the beginning of the kind of flow from taking an idea, an initiative into something that can be truly disruptive, truly, truly change making. So I've seen that work at the Digital Innovation Lab for VW. I've also seen another thing, the World Food Program. There is one guy who sometimes gets a lot of stick, but in the larger kind of space, he's done a fantastic job, a man named Houman Haddad. And Houman was the guy who built out Building Blocks. And Building Blocks is the largest humanitarian blockchain-based transfer system. Now, I have some questions about how much of a disruption, how much of a jump into the future that really is. But that's my own questions. Regardless, the way that he got it to work was Houman just doggedly worked to make sure that people listened to him and that he would get it created, and struggled continuously against the organization. So that's the second thing. Failing those individuals being there at the beginning, you need a strong-headed, strong-minded, and relatively stubborn individual to take it forward. If I think like the tactical things for that kind of relationship between the larger organism and then the newer ideas. And then I think the third thing is at an organizational level, you need high-level buy-in, right? Everybody's talked about high-level buy-in. I'm just repeating what more intelligent, more well-researched people have said in the past, but high level of buy-in. But I think the second thing is actually being clear about what your exit paths are. When you're building a venture studio, being very, very clear about what your actual exit paths are. If you say your exit path is out of the organization, then you need to build the structures to lead that organism outside of the organization. You need to have a very clear, it might not always be the same process, but you need to at least understand the stages in that process to get that organization set up, organized, to ensure you have a person that is willing to lead it, the recruitment, the structure around that organism. You must think of it like that single cell organism that then needs to replicate and grow itself. That needs to be protected. It needs to have a strong membrane that allows it then to exist outside of the organization. If it's going into the organization, well, then you have to think of it like a virus, right? And maybe not the right word to use right now, but in any case, a virus goes to your system, fuses with a cell, and then takes over the system, right? And so we have to consider what the latching of the virus is into the cell. If your connector is not connecting with anything inside the organization, well, then it's not going to work. So how do you ensure that the connector of your intervention, of your idea, of this new thing can connect into the cell where it will start replicating and growing to then really disrupt and change your organization? And obviously different organizations face this differently. Digital organizations face it in a very, very different way to a massive logistics provider, because a massive logistics provider, if it needs to change, if it needs to move the tanker, like they always say, it needs to sell off vehicles, it needs to change supply systems, it needs to change what, maybe to think of it like a bit like an oak, right? It's very easy for us to take a shovel and then take a seedling out of the oak in one place and then put it somewhere else. But at the point when that oak tree has grown to 300 years old, you can't get it out of the ground. It's gonna die there, right? In that space. It's gonna be very challenging for you to lift that damn tree out of the ground. It's the same way for organizations. If you think about, I always think about this when I'm flying. When I'm flying and looking down on the earth, I always look at cities and I think, wow, they look very much like bacteria. They seem to grow. And isn't there that amazing research that was done in Japan around a specific mushroom? And they created in a petri dish a few kind of food sources, and then they implanted the mushroom and it created the Tokyo sub. we're exactly the, in many ways, we're exactly the same as the nature that has created us. We are growing our roots in very, very similar ways. And if we want to remain live, we have to understand how to chop roots off, which talks back to that disruption, and be clear about how we grow and change as organisms. And I think that's a very interesting question to ask, and how you might do that in very legacy businesses. Sorry, that was a lot there.
This was great. The yin to the yang is, of course, the question of what do you find are the common pitfalls, the common obstacles, the things you stumble over. And clearly, there's all the inverse to what you just said. That's the easy one. I wonder if there's other ones you found, like the red flags, the things when you walk into an organization or you design an organization and you're like, whoa, we need to be careful. This can get in our way.
Well, I guess I talked about a couple there, which is one, if there's no buy-in, then, then that's not going to work. The second one is in venture studios, the people who lead them need to have a certain amount of fearlessness. If you think back to, again, this talks against his Safi Bakal's loon shots, but he talks a lot about Vannevar Bush and Vannevar Bush effectively being quite, what's the word? The word I'm looking for is escaping my mind, but maybe insolent is the right way of putting it. Being slightly insolent in front of four-star generals because he has the buy-in from the president. And ultimately, he has the ability to be fearless, and he's been given the space to be fearless. If you do not have a fearless leader in a venture studio, the likelihood is we're going to piss people off, right? Whenever we create something new, we're likely going to piss someone off because we're not threatening. Sometimes we think, oh, all these people, they're so stuck in the past. Well, that's not the case. They know something. They've created a family, a livelihood. They have a way of living that has allowed them to exist the way that they have. And if we change that, it creates stress. And we don't know what else is going on in their lives. Now, in some ways, we have to ignore that level of empathy, where we have to be slightly ruthless in being like, this is a good idea, we're going to have to try it. Whilst at the same time, at a larger organizational level, we have to think about how we either provide those individuals with new purposes and new abilities to continue working, or we have to give them the right off-ramp. And that's kind of what I meant when talking about chopping off a root. If we look at, for example, my orchids, right? When my orchid grows and I haven't watered it for a little while, what happens is it removes the energy to one of its branches or one of its stems. Mm-hmm. We do exactly the same in organizations. And it's a bit ruthless. But ultimately, that's when we talk about disruption, innovation, there will always be that kind of looming over us to a certain extent, I think. So I think red flag number one, buy-in. Red flag number two, trying to please everyone. Red flag number three is, in most cases, there is always an element of inspiration that comes with this process. And I believe there needs to be at least one person who can inspire within your organization. If there is no one who is inspiring action, then the likelihood again is that the motivation is going to dwindle, I think. And I've noticed this in a few of the places I've worked. Yeah. What other red flags might there be? And I think the most important one is lies. I think there's sometimes there is a value in exaggerating slightly, right? But then you need to hold up to the claims. And I think one travels down a dangerous path if one relies on image of what it is, what it looks like someone is doing rather than the actual results of what is actually happening. Measuring well is an art as well as a science. It's very, very, very easy to measure things nowadays. It's very hard to measure the right things, in my opinion. And to be clear about what it is we are measuring, why we are measuring, and for how long we will be measuring it. Because if I'm trying to change my direction, I have to consider that if I'm setting... As we are an object-oriented species, pretty much, you set me a task, I'm probably going to go and satisfy that task, you say, within a specific set of guidelines. But measuring well, I think I've seen that done very, very poorly in very, very, very many places.
Gustav, let me wrap this with a last question. This is my typically closing question. I'm curious from your perspective, how bullish or bearish, how much do you believe this is actually possible for incumbent organizations, your oak trees, to stay in your metaphor? How much do you believe we can do this? How optimistic or pessimistic are you about this?
Well, the real question there is, what is this?
Innovation.
This being innovation.
Relevant.
Well, I guess there is a... So number one, I think we probably don't give enough credit to these large organizations that currently exist. There are some where you can arguably ask questions in terms of how they're operating, like the whole Exxon debacle lately. You ask questions about whether what they're doing is ethical, right, and actually benefiting the world. I think, so from a tactical standpoint, in terms of the systems and structures that one needs to put together to actually make innovation possible and ensure that the people inside your organization are enabled to take their ideas and turn them into innovations. And I phrase it that way for a specific reason. Organizations don't create innovation, people do. It's about creating the enabling environment. Tactically, creating the enabling environment is possible. It's possible, and many, many organizations have done it. Doing it in a way that is sustainable, a little bit more difficult. Many, many organizations, I mean, Xerox, fantastic example. Xerox, one of the most innovative businesses in the world, failed miserably, became just a printer business. Whereas many of the innovations that we use today were created through the Xerox labs. Same, to a certain extent, same with Bell Labs. There are many organizations that have flailingly failed. But so creating sustainable, continuous change within incumbent organizations is 100% a challenge. But is it possible? I do believe that it is. I think that we've seen it enough times now for it to be possible. That still doesn't say whether you can be prepared for tectonic changes in the structure of your industry. So there's a different question between can you be an innovative organization versus can you radically change the underpinnings of your business structure? Take Nokia and the smartphone. The smartphone, many, many times at Nokia, they talked about and came up with the ideas of building a smartphone. But it never happened. And you presented this really well in the Be Radical sessions, right? Where you talked about how well Steve Jobs brought together the various components and noticed that specific moment in time when it was right to create the smartphone. So it's still difficult for an organization to jump on the idea when it's ripe and also be ready for the tectonic change that can take place if they're not. But that does not mean that they cannot be disruptive and they cannot be innovative. So maybe that's the answer.
Gustav, I love this. This was an absolutely amazing conversation. I love the wide-ranging topic. I loved your metaphors. I have to admit that I will add the oak tree now to my growing arsenal of metaphors. I absolutely love the image. It's so powerful. Thank you again for sharing your insights. Really, really enjoyed this conversation. And for you, as you're embarking on your own reinvention and journey, all the very best.
Thank you very much, Pascal. As always, it's great to talk.
Hey, it's Pascal. Thanks for tuning in on this episode of Disrupt Disruption. If you want more, check out the other episodes we have on this podcast. Also know that this is part of an effort of us writing a book about disruption. So keep your eyes and ears peeled towards that. And if you liked it, do us a favor. Go on your podcasting platform of choice, iTunes, Google Play, whatever it is, and just like this. There's some weird algorithm thing, which, you know, if you like it, they will like us. So do me a favor, do that. And if you've got any questions, any comments, anyone I should talk to, drop us an email. Easiest email address for me to reach it is p@finet.com. With that being said, thank you so much for listening, and I will hear you here soon.